the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political-economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago.
Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global form by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation. But this time, it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by 0.25% next month, most likely 0.5% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I have also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics say Western powers were wrong not to listen to Moscow's security concerns as they built up military capabilities close to Russia's borders and refused to rule out Ukraine joining NATO. ECB bosses are due to meet again to discuss the financial crisis on the 21st of July. Many are asking if the EU's focus stays on arming Ukraine and not conflict resolution, how can things possibly improve between now and then. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A daily occurrence in Donetsk, a building going up in smoke. It was hit by Ukrainian shelling. This time it's an industrial warehouse, but targets like this are not usual.
Now, working as a journalist here, whenever I have nothing else planned, I simply follow the incoming here in Donetsk. And when I arrived at the fifth school that had been hit in as many days, the penny started to drop. And I asked my translator, a local woman with her two-year-old child herself, does the Ukrainian army intentionally shell schools? She replied as if it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, yes, they've been doing it for the last 8 years.
School 5, 13, 22, 33, 57, 106, 114, 116. There are dozens more. So why is Ukraine purposefully targeting schools? In 2014, when the shelling began, former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko made this famous speech.
Because we will have our jobs and they will not. We will have our pensions and they will not. We will have care for our children, people and retirees, and they will not. Our children will go to schools and kindergartens, and theirs will hole up in the basements because they are not able to do a thing. This is exactly how we will win this war.
Six schools were hit only this week. They would like to create a humanitarian crisis here, so as many of us leave as possible. They think that this is their land and the Russian-speaking people are foreigners. They want us to leave to Russia. That's why they shell civilians here every day.
In 2014, School 57 was hit on the exact day the students returned for the school year. 10 people were killed.
Now, for obvious reasons, for the last 8 years, children here in Donetsk have learnt from home. The school around the corner was hit on the 30th of May this year. And on that day, children were expected or scheduled to come back to school for exams, which begs the question, are the Ukrainian army trying to maximize casualties here at these schools?
There are wounded and killed people every day. Children are dying too. My son is 4 years old. He hasn't seen peaceful life yet. He knows what war is, though. And he likes the soldiers who defend us. When my district was on the shelling, we were hiding in the corridor. He was afraid. He took the phone and started shouting into it, "Please, soldiers, come and help us." I think every mom here has got a similar story.
During 8 years of conflict, 117 children have been killed in the DPR. The Ukrainian government claims the city is still part of its country. The inescapable fact is that NATO is arming a government that is using its weapons to blow up, as it claims, its own schools and to target children. Perhaps the most shocking part of this story is that most of the world has turned a blind eye to the mountain of evidence of these crimes for 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Thousands of Iranian Muslims have come together in capital Tehran to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Reza, the eighth infallible Shia Imam. People from different walks of life took part in the ceremony to pay respect to the lofty status of Imam Reza, who is considered by Iranians as a symbol of divine love and affection.
I'm here to say that we love Imam Reza from the bottom of our hearts. I have raised my children with a love for Imam Reza. We are ready to die for him, and we will continue his path.
The ceremony comes almost 10 days after France awarded a movie titled Holy Spider during the Cannes Film Festival, which Muslims believed insulted Islamic sanctities.
Iranian officials believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider is insulting and politically motivated, and is the product of the confused mind of a Danish-Iranian filmmaker, sponsored and financed by global arrogance.
People strongly condemn the move by France, saying such a sacrilegious act will never be forgotten.
I want to send this message to the enemies that the light of the sun will never fade away. So the name and the path of Imam Reza will remain forever, and the enemies' plots will never bear any results.
I believe that awarding the movie Holy Spider has been totally politically motivated, and it was an open insult to Islamic sanctities. We condemn such a movie, and we condemn such a sacrilegious act against Islam.
The participants believe that the large gathering of Muslim believers has sent this message to the enemies of Islam, that Muslims will never remain silent and indifferent towards any insult against their sanctities, and they are ready to defend their Islamic values and beliefs until the last drop of their blood. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The moment an exhibition turned into a series of violent assaults committed by the MKO, a cult-like organization that has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. Press TV's camera crew, reporting on an exhibition showcasing MKO bombings and assassinations, was attacked by angry supporters of the group.
Don't touch my camera. Don't touch my camera. Go deep. Don't touch my camera. You go deep.
After being driven out of post-revolution Iran, the MKO based itself in Camp Ashraf in Iraq, where members were forced to pledge allegiance to its leader Massoud Rajavi and demonstrate that allegiance with cult-like behavior. For women, that meant divorcing their husbands and marrying him. Many families spent years on the fringes of the camp begging for their children to be released, but to no avail. The camp was later dismantled in the wake of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Until 2012, the MKO was on the U.S. terrorist list. It was also blacklisted by the EU until 2009. Since being removed, the new leader of the cult, Maryam Rajavi, has forged close relationships with Western officials. What unfolded on the streets of Stockholm today was a shocking reminder that the EU has become a safe haven for the MKO, which attacks journalists like myself with little fear of retribution. The question now is, will there be an investigation? Bianca Rahimi, Stockholm.
We are visiting Afghan food markets, where prices are hiking day by day. Food items are short, and people don't have cash to buy them. Customers here tell us about their struggle to provide food and livelihoods.
If I save the whole salary of my 20 days of work, I will be able to buy a sack of flour, because I hardly can make only a dollar per day. However, most of the days, I'm without a job. In such a situation where prices are also skyrocketing, I can no longer provide livelihoods for my family.
On Wednesday, the UN chief said the impacts of the war in Ukraine have generated food and finance crises globally, with vulnerable ones being hit hard. Afghan experts say Afghanistan is among the countries affected harshly.
Previously, the prices of food items, including that of flour, were lower. Since the beginning of Russia-Ukraine conflict, the prices have started to rise. Then a sack of flour was $17, but now it is nearly $30. Unfortunately, our country is also facing an unprecedented drought that has a significant role in food shortages.
In the meantime, Afghan traders and businessmen also complain about the severe impacts of freezing Afghan assets by the U.S. and global sanctions on the country.
The U.S. seizing of Afghan assets has left a severe effect on our markets and livelihoods. Earlier, a dollar was exchanged with 77 Afghanis, but now, due to U.S. sanctions, a dollar has been raised to 89. We urge the U.S. and the international community to not add to the miseries of Afghan people and free their frozen funds as soon as possible.
Following the Taliban takeover, the U.S. and allies froze some $9 billion in Afghan central bank assets, and major funding to the country was halted. Sanctions and ripple effects from the war in Ukraine have triggered food crisis in Afghanistan. Most people here say they can afford a single sack of flour, since the prices have more than doubled. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
We're on our way to the front line, outside the key Ukrainian stronghold of Adievka. We pull up by the side of the road. It feels like no man's land.
The town is fortified well, but we're working on them, dismantling their dugouts with artillery. We're making passages in their defenses and going deeper. You can hear our volleys now.
Now, it's too dangerous to take the car along this road, as it can be a target for anti-tank missiles fired from the Ukrainians, who are just about a kilometer in that direction, so we're going on foot.
These fighters are from the Donbas, now loyal to Russia. They've been fighting here against Ukrainian nationalists for 8 years. Trench warfare has returned once again to Europe. While some of the world's most advanced weapons are slaughtering dozens of soldiers every day, the best defense remains underground. The living quarters, it's infested with kittens. The soldiers tell me that they have them at every outpost. They bring good luck, they say. More likely, much needed comfort in this brutal war. Now, Adyevka is just over in that direction there. It's so well fortified that risking a frontal attack would cost so many lives, or indeed may not even be possible. That's why the Russian army is trying to encircle the Ukrainian army to the north of here. And then, after it does that, if it's able to do that, they plan to come down here and take Adyevka. Because to take Donbass, the whole of Donbass, it's major fortifications like this which will have to be taken as well.
The remains of mortar shells. The trenches are doing their job. It's been some time since Russia has released its casualty figures, perhaps because the number might be hard for Russian people to swallow. But it's clear, with overwhelming air and artillery superiority, Russia is winning this war, where the fighting is fiercest. The next outpost, as promised, more kittens. Russian soldiers are being dehumanized by Ukrainian propaganda as monsters and orcs, leading to atrocities committed against Russian POWs. But it's clear these soldiers are very human indeed. Upon hearing I was British, one of the soldiers appealed to me to tell the truth about what was happening here to people back in the UK. I asked him what that truth was.
That there's a genocide of the Russian-speaking population going on here. The Ukrainians have been shelling our people for 8 years. They are trying to extinguish us. Tell them about this at least. At any moment, I can die here, but I am on my land and I will fight for it.
No doubt the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches across the fields will have a very different version of the truth. Compromise is being achieved through war. Appropriately for this European conflict, poppies grow in the trenches. Many years from now, perhaps soldiers from both sides will be able to commemorate their fallen comrades together. But for now, the battle for the Donbass rages on. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Climatenomics by former White House reporter and director of environmental entrepreneurs Bob Keefe is a narrative account of how the climate crisis is fundamentally altering not just the US but global economics. We are prepared for you an article written by Edward Helmore. The piece is titled New Book Says Climate Crisis is Battering US Economy and Driving Inflation. According to a new book, Forget Ukraine, Coronavirus, Corporate Greed and Supply Chain Issues. When it comes to inflation, the climate crisis is the real lasting worry, and one that's only likely to get worse. Climatenomics, by former White House reporter and director of environmental entrepreneurs Bob Keefe, is a narrative account of how the climate crisis is fundamentally altering not just the US, but global economics. Within its pages, Bob Keefe lays out what he sees as the false choice between creating jobs and driving economic growth and protecting the planet, and how supply chain disruptions has become a euphemism for the effects of climate change. Keefe says, "I don't think people have realized that climate change is an economic issue now, because it's always been seen as an environmental, health or social issue." He added, "The fact of the matter is climate change is battering our economy." Political and monetary policy leaders hinted as much recently after the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen acknowledged that inflation had reached unacceptable highs. It hit a 40-year high of 8.6% in the year to the end of May. 2 days later, the White House said, "Our hemisphere is facing the devastating impacts and costs of climate change," ahead of Joe Biden's Summit of the Americas in the city of Los Angeles. Assessing the role of climate change on economies is one thing, but for now, most models merely assess the cost of climate-related disasters, not their underlying effect on inflation. According to Bob Keefe, citing National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration figures, climate-related weather disasters cost the U.S. economy more than $145 billion in 2021, a nearly 50% increase from last year. Over the last 5 years, they have cost $750 billion. Since 1980, 323 weather and climate disasters have cost $1 billion or more, the total cost of these events exceeding $2.195 trillion. Moreover, according to a report from the reinsurance firm Swiss Re last year, climate disasters could cost the American economy 10% of gross domestic product, or GDP, the broadest measure of economic health, by 2050. Globally, that figure rises to 18%. A 2018 National Climate Assessment projects that rising temperatures and extreme heat are projected to decrease worker productivity by $221 billion a year by 2090, and climate-related weather disasters are projected to cost the U.S. $500 billion a year. Another study published in Environmental Research Letters in July of last year found long-term warming contributed $27 billion to the losses covered by the U.S. Crop Insurance Program from 1991 to 2017, or just over 19% of the total. In 2012, the single costliest year, rising temperatures contributed nearly half of losses valued at $18.6 billion. While each of those relate to gross domestic product and productivity, none specifically refer to inflation and inflationary pressure, prices rising over time, and are not factored into official government statistics related by the Bureau of Labor's Consumer Price Index, the CPI, which measures the changing prices of a basket of goods and services. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and the Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell have faced criticism for initially describing inflation as a transitory problem that would resolve itself. Janet Yellen has admitted that her initial evaluation of the economy was wrong and that she and Jerome Powell could have used a better term than transitory. She said that the bulk of inflation was related to imbalances in supply and demand. But that, too, has climate component, says David Supper, a professor of law and economics at Georgetown University, who argues that climate change is largely ignored as an inflationary driver, in part because it is manifesting as a global problem in overt and covert ways that makes the direct inflationary impact hard to assess. David Supper says, "Its impact is broad and systemic, so there is no one item in the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, that you can say reflects climate change. We can say that grain and gas oil costs reflect the Ukraine war, but you can't do that with climate change because it affects so many things. Loss of timber and homes due to wildfires in the western United States might show up in housing construction costs, or the cost of retrofitting homes to guard against coastal erosion and flooding." David Supper points out, right there you have several things that are either increasing demand or undermining supply, and that's just one small part of it. Similarly, supply chain issues frequently cited as inflationary may not simply be issues around China COVID lockdowns affecting manufacturing, but a range of issues from roads washing out or loss of crops due to extreme weather events and shifting weather patterns. The Consumer Price Index, the CPI, is focused on results and not causes. The responsibility to assess causes rests with the White House Council of Economic Advisers, or National Economic Council. Bodies that have attempted to come out with estimates that have been met with challenges to their data by climate deniers, resulting in paralysis. David Supper says that has led to less eagerness to do estimations in areas where a lot of estimates would have to be made because there's so little inclination to assume those estimates would be done in good faith. He added, in the face of a well-funded climate denier industry, the estimates get turned into a sideshow. Shifting the climate crisis from an environmental to an economic issue is at the heart of what climatonomics presents. Bob Keefe says what's required is an effort similar in scale to the shift from the industrial to the information age to renewable energy, and with it, provisions to counter climate change's increasing disruption. Bob Keefe says, what we do know is that the economic cost of climate change, both from weather disasters and commodities costs, is taking an increasing toll on economies. But if one of the major inflationary forces is climate, it's also one that can't be tackled simply by central bankers adjusting interest rates. According to David Supper, seeing climate change as an environmental issue, which it is, but not as an economic issue, which it surely is as well, is now in the process of changing. David Supper says the current round of inflation has widened people's eyes to it. Sure, the pandemic and the war in Ukraine are part of it, but I think this is a teachable moment that will allow people to see just how pervasive climate change is in affecting the way we live. We have framed the climate concern in extremely narrow ways, never a good idea with a complex social phenomena or with something as all-encompassing as this.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
While the U.S. is entangled in the Ukraine conflict, it is also pursuing another confrontational approach on the other side of the world, namely with China. At the Shangri-La Dialogue Security Summit, which ended in Singapore, China's defense minister hit back at the Pentagon chief Lloyd Austin, who accused Beijing of, quote, destabilizing military activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at what steps Beijing would take when it says that it had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Mike Billington joins us from the Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, Virginia. Also joining us is Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mike Billington, I'll first start with you. When you have the U.S. Defense Minister meeting his counterpart from China face-to-face for the first time, he issues a warning pretty much, saying that Beijing must refrain from further destabilizing actions towards Taiwan, and that's a quote. Do you think that that's the right approach that the U.S. is using in this case in point in that summit which ended from the U.S. Defense Minister?
Oh, I think it's actually worse than that. I think it's good that they met, but what Austin did was totally in keeping with the incredibly belligerent, provocative moves by the U.S. towards Russia and towards China. I will add something to what you quoted from Austin, which I think is far more ominous. He said at one point, and I'll read this, he said that we will continue to fulfill our commitments under the Taiwan Relations Act, that's normal, and that includes assisting Taiwan in maintaining a sufficient self-defense capability. That's also normal, that's part of the longstanding U.S. policy. But then he goes on and says, and it means maintaining our own capacity to resist any use of force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize the security or the social or economic system of the people of Taiwan. Now think of that. That is an open declaration refuting absolutely even the ambiguity policy of the U.S. and explicitly it confirms what President Biden said, which many people described as a gaffe, that we would militarily defend Taiwan in the case of a conflict, which means that if the Chinese government chooses by force or whatever reason that they have to consolidate their sovereignty over their province of Taiwan under the One China, Two Systems policy, that the U.S. would launch a global war. Does he mean that? Is this meant to be simply provocative to get China to back down? It's very difficult to say, but the problem we're facing is that the U.S. and the British and the NATO forces have repeatedly stated that they intend to win this fight to prevent Russia and China, and by the way, most of the rest of the world, which does not support the sanctions on Russia and does not support the demonization of China, but in fact continue to support Russia and China and have economic relations with them. But does it mean that they will either submit to the now obviously no longer true unipolar world?
Sure.
The myth that the U.S. continues to be the only force in the world and that the so-called rules-based order, which simply means the rules we make after having won the Cold War, as they like to put it, rather than the international law established by all nations after World War II. The UN and international law has been basically dismissed by this policy.
All right, Richard Becker, what are we to make of U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China, when you have what our guest Mike Billington said there from Lloyd Austin, where he then comes out in the same forum saying another thing, such as reaffirming the importance of peace and stability across the strait, opposition to unilateral changes to the status quo, and calling on China to refrain from further destabilizing action towards Taiwan. To add and to question then, what Mike Billington said, do you believe that the U.S., if China did make a move, would react and therefore start a war with China?
I think that we have to assume that that very well could happen. And we should remember that February, just this past February, the end of February, marked the 50th anniversary of the Shanghai Communique. And the Shanghai Communique was issued in the Nixon presidency, with Kissinger taking the lead in this, and between the U.S. and the People's Republic of China, saying that parties on both sides of the strait recognize that there is one China. What we see happening now means that that has been completely overturned by the United States. That declaration that there is one China. In fact, the United States is engaging in the most provocative behavior pouring weaponry and trainers, and we don't know how many U.S. troops and trainers and advisors there are now in Taiwan, but we have to assume that it's a great many, really the U.S. is treating the neocons who are running the foreign policy in Washington are treating Taiwan not as if it's part of China. They never fully did, but now it's very blatant that they're treating Taiwan as an independent country. And more importantly, though, than that, in fact, is that they don't really care about what happens to people in Taiwan. They don't care what happens to people in the Philippines or Okinawa or Japan. They are all part of what the Pentagon calls the first island chain. That is, they view them as bases. And it was just a few months ago that the head of the Indo-PAC, as they now call it, military command for the U.S., said that the first island chain countries must be prepared for war, not just war, but to be able to come back. After they are first attacked, they have to have redundancy in their weaponry so that they can continue fighting against China in the event of a war, which I think that everyone believes is very welcoming. So, I think that's an important point to make. The pretense in Washington that they care about the interests of any people has to be thrown out the window and replaced with reality, which is that this is a struggle to bring China down, to bring Russia and China down. And it's not my words. In 2017, the end of 2017, and ratified in early 2018, the latest national security strategy says that the war against terrorism has been replaced with major power competition or major power rivalry. And with the U.S. meaning that Russia and China are the targets and the context of the drive to make the U.S. the one and only superpower in the world. That's what the end really is.
Well, let's hopefully clarify through you, Mike Billington, the deal that the U.S. has with these countries that it has military bases on. I know there's a status of forces agreement that it has with Japan. What is that exactly? From what I understand is that the U.S. can order the Japanese military, if it wants to take military action, for them to oblige, if that's a correct understanding of it. But what type of control does the U.S. have when it comes to these island nations or any country in that part of the world that they have bases in and their militaries?
Well, they have a serious problem in the Philippines from their view, because especially under the Duterte administration, but almost certainly also under the Marcos administration, that they will return to the kind of policy under Marcos's father, Ferdinand Marcos, who was one of the great nationalist leaders of Asia, who industrialized his country, built nuclear power plants, made the country self-sufficient in agriculture. And it was for that reason that they demonized him and ran a color revolution to have him deposed, after which the country deteriorated into being one of the most poorest and most oppressed countries in the region. So they're not sure they're going to have access to the military bases that they have, in a sense, still in the Philippines, within the Philippine bases. As to whether or not Japan will follow dictates, you might say, to join in such a war, Prime Minister Kishida gave the keynote at the Shangri-La Dialogue, where Austin was speaking, in which he echoed all of the U.S., NATO, British demonization of Russia, that he's fully joined in the attacks on Russia, and then said that that the China problem with Taiwan, that they're belligerent, they're aggressive, and that they're going to rebuild their military over the next 5 years. Now, I will add to that, though, a voice of caution. There is a upper house election in Japan early next month. There will not be another election for about 3 years. There are many, including friends of mine in Japan, former high-level officials, who believe that Kishida is making these kinds of statements in full support of the outrageous war policies coming out of the U.S. and Britain, more for domestic purposes, and that following the election, when there won't be another election for about 3 years, that he will modify this and return more to the kind of policy Abe had of being friendly with Russia and doing business with China and maintaining a certain balance. I will also add that there is there's a fight back taking place around the world against this U.S. British unipolar world mentality. Jai Shankar, the foreign minister of India, just last week said, Eurocentrism is dead. We will no longer follow dictates. And of course, that includes the U.S. from the West. Meeting of the South American, the Nations of the Americas meeting in Los Angeles, in which the U.S. refused to invite three members because they considered them, you know, authoritarian dictatorships, led to the complete collapse of that event. Not only did Mexico and the Triangle countries not attend, they just boycotted it and said, we're not going to tolerate your dictating who are members of the Latin American countries. But also Fernandez from Argentina, who did go, blasted this as an outrage. There are forces within the U.S., former high-level Army JAG officer, Colonel Richard Black, whose video warning that the U.S. mobilization for war against Russia, potentially nuclear war, with China obviously next in line, that this is madness, that this is creating a danger to humanity, and that this video has now 750,000 views. This is an interview I did with Colonel Black for the Schiller Institute. So there are reasons to be relatively optimistic if we fight hard now to inform, break through the information of war being waged by the Western media and the Western financial system, and bring these kinds of realities to the American people as well as the Europeans, that we can turn this situation away from the disaster it's heading for now. And partially, that's because the hyperinflationary breakdown of the Western financial system is affecting everybody. Everybody now knows that the Western financial structure is in a state of total decay and collapse. Therefore, people have to think about what can we do to bring about a new paradigm of the sort that the Schiller Institute and Helga Zepp LaRouche have been fighting for with our conferences and our videos.
Well, Richard Becker, Mike Billington talked about the nuclear possibility between Russia and the States. There was a statement that came out of China that is pretty interesting that was made by the defense minister to his counterpart. And he said something about to the point where there's been significant progress that China has made in developing new arms. And this is in regards to its nuclear arsenal. So that was in itself somewhat eye-opening. But then he made this statement: I wonder if you have seen China's 70th anniversary National Day military parade and the new weapons and equipment available to the Chinese military, in which he then went on to say, but we don't engage in an arms race. So is that a subtle hint as to what the U.S. would face if it wanted to go on a military adventure with China?
Well, first of all, let me say, I must take exception with your other guest characterization of the Marcos regime. It was really the U.S. Marcos regime that was overthrown by an uprising of the people. And the U.S., back in 1986, and the U.S. managed to transition it to another subservient regime. As far as what's going on in regard to the speak of the of China's military buildup, what does anyone think that China would do in the face of a massive U.S. military buildup? I mean, this is a vast buildup throughout Asia surrounding China, in Taiwan. Japan still, I have to point out, Japan still has at least 84 military, U.S. military bases. Most of them are joint bases, or many of them are joint bases between the so-called Japan Self-Defense Forces and the U.S. That 84 doesn't even include Okinawa, which is covered, or 20% or so of the land or more is U.S. military bases in Okinawa, and then there's Korea. I mean, there's a vast deployment of military, of U.S. military already in place, and more coming, that the buildup is underway, and it is continuing. So whenever we hear people say, And like the U.S. generals, they're alarmed by China developing new forms of weaponry. Really? I mean, that is so ludicrous when it comes out of the mouths of those who represent the biggest military contractor in the world by far, the biggest arms sales in the world, and the number one power in terms of developing new weapon systems, including modernizing, quote unquote, put the word in quotation marks, its nuclear arsenal. What's that for? I mean, that's promises nothing except death and destruction and possibly the annihilation of life on the planet. Sure. That's what we really see happening with the danger that we see coming from the U.S. aggression in against Russia. And Defense Secretary, and again, I would put that in quotation marks, Lloyd Austin, said just a few weeks ago, the aim of the U.S. is not supporting or protecting the Ukrainian people, it's to weaken Russia. And the U.S. is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian to do that.
Well, and since we're quickly running out of time, I have to ask your reaction, Mike Billington, on what the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said just last month. I mean, it really lays out the way that the U.S. feels about China, in which he says China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order, and that Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress. But I thought the impression that everybody had was that, and the U.S. included, was that China is technologically more advanced, like the 5G technology that it has. And yet Blinken's statement there is a diversion from that.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, what Blinken means by universal values are the values that allow the United States to wage regime change wars anywhere it wishes over and over and over again. I agree with most of what Richard has been saying. I will just say that if you want to get a sense of how one of the first color revolutions, the way that Marcos was overthrown, I encourage you to go to the Executive Intelligence Review website and read my material on how George Shultz and Paul Wolfowitz ran that so-called People's Power Revolt, which was a model then for their efforts to destroy countries all over the world through color revolutions. As to the blatant policy of Blinken following in line with the Obama policies, Obama-Biden policies for basically imposing regime change wars in places like Ukraine in 2014 and now openly running an effort to overthrow the regimes in Russia and China, that this is a policy which is only going to be reversed if we can bring the world together, including the U.S., to recognize that what is really threatening humanity right now is that the Western financial system is in a state of total collapse. We're holding a conference on the 18th and 19th next weekend on the theme that there will be no peace if the Western financial system is not put through bankruptcy reorganization. This is possible at this point. Because, as I said, everybody in the world is now aware of the devastating breakdown crisis, hyperinflationary breakdown crisis of that financial system, and that Russia and China have been working very closely together. Sergei Glazyev from Russia and Wang Wen from the Chongyang Institute for Financial Studies at Renmin University in formulating a new financial policy for the world, not
exactly.
Just for themselves, not just trading in local currencies, but putting together an alternative which we can and must bring the United States through a popular mobilization to join with them. And our conference on the 18th and 19th,
well,
the Schiller Institute conference, will focus on that urgent necessity.
Sure. There is a lot of talk on this, Richard Becker, and we don't have that much time to talk about it, but there appears to be a very gigantic tectonic shift, if I may use that word, of a new world order, financially speaking, of which one of it is the fact that the U.S. dollar strength is going to decrease as we're seeing the forces move forward, such as the way that Russia and Iran, for example, are experiencing the way that they evade sanctions. And, of course, there's also the question of energy, where you have countries like Russia, Iran, and just the recent visit by Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to Iran. You have these major oil powerhouses in one camp. Of course, you also can talk about Russia, China in that picture, where it all points to the U.S. Influence and power on the wane here. Are we looking at that to be the savior to prevent another war from happening? Because the war with China, I think, would be a totally different ballgame than the one that we're seeing with Ukraine.
Yeah, you know, I think that I just came back last night from Los Angeles from the People's Summit for Democracy, where well over 1,000 people from all over the hemisphere gathered as a counterpoint to the Organization of American States failed summit of the Americas. I mean, really a failure, a true humiliation for the United States, where the leaders of 20 countries, the heads of 20 states in the Americas did not show up in protest of the U.S. embargo, sanctions, blockade policy against Cuba, against Venezuela, and the exclusion of those two countries and the leadership of and the leaders of Nicaragua or any representation from Nicaragua. And so their summit was a failure. I mean, it was a complete failure, and the People's Summit was a true success. And I think it was a sign that the U.S. policy, that the U.S. power is slipping in different parts of the world. I think we have to also take into account, though, that when that happens, the imperialists may become more aggressive, more adventuristic, and I think that's something we have to be very concerned about. We have to build a people's movement on the ground in solidarity with each other across the Americas and across the world to call for an end to U.S. aggression and belligerence and the threat of new wars, even more destructive wars.
Okay, Mike Billington, final question along the same lines of what I asked Richard Becker. When you have so much energy focused on a number of countries that are not U.S. friendly, to say the least, let's just imagine if Russia actually takes over Ukraine by some sense and takes over their production of grain, you could see that then you have food in that picture also. Then is that something that would prevent the U.S. from its hegemonic aspirations or its expansionist policies, as we see?
Well, again, the only way reversed is for people to recognize that the driving force behind the U.S.-British-NATO push for war against Russia and against China, not Ukraine, it's not Taiwan. Baker is right that they have for the people in Ukraine or the people in Taiwan. The purpose is that the Western financial system is breaking down, and they see that Russia and China have posed an alternative, and their reaction is
all right. I'm sorry, I got to jump in, Mike Billington. We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Wish we had more time. Mike Billington from the Executive Intelligence Review, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition. Thank you to you both. And with that, we